Welcome. Jump into the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast, where leading with love isn't just nice, it's genius. I'm Laurel Donnellan.
And I'm Daryl Brown. We'll unpack business strategies infused with empathy and action, driving both profit and purpose. Our world is ever-changing, so discover how the savvy leader wears compassion as their power suit.
It is my great honor to welcome Emily Rosado Solomon, who is an assistant professor at Babson College, to the Compassionate Leaders Circle podcast. And we have Amy Gilliland, who is the president of GDIT, which stands for General Dynamics Information Technology. Did I get that right, Amy?
Perfect.
We're here today to talk about mental health and mental illness in the workplace. Amy, as a practitioner, helping her employees with that topic, and Emily as a researcher that recently did a review paper with her colleagues. Welcome. We're so excited to have you both.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, super excited.
And you haven't met each other. So this is, you're our coffee clatch with each other. So I'd like to start with both of you just giving a little bit of background of Emily, maybe you could share with our listeners about the wonderful Babson College, where you are a professor, and a little bit about your background, and then I'll have Amy do the same.
Sure. So Babson College is a relatively small private college in Wellesley, Massachusetts, right outside of Boston. And our focus is really on entrepreneurship and entrepreneurial thought and action. So teaching students how to either become entrepreneurs themselves or to be entrepreneurial in their future careers. And this is actually just my second year at Babson. I came from a different institution, but it is also very focused on experiential learning. So we do a lot where we teach students about how to be good corporate citizens, collaborate with one another, innovate with one another, disagree respectfully and productively. And then they actually get to do that by starting their own business. So in their freshman year, everybody has worked for a startup where they actually are buying and selling things. And so it is a really cool environment because that entrepreneurial sort of innovative spirit transfers over into how we think about research as faculty members. And so my background is I have my PhD in human relations and industrial relations and from Rutgers University. And my primary research interests are mental health and mental illness in organizations and sort of the intersection of mental health and work. And my secondary focuses are sort of in how people relate to each other more broadly in the workplace, and then also issues of diversity and inclusion. And so I'm really excited to be here to discuss some of that mental health research.
And I only hear great things about Babson College. A friend of mine's son just graduated and started a fitness business. So I know from the inside out that it's pretty fabulous. And I'm curious about this with Amy, but I find that entrepreneurial skills are also really important in this fast changing world in the corporate world. Would you agree, Amy?
Oh, absolutely. Emily, just reading your work, first of all, I want to thank you for the research that you're doing on mental health, such an important aspect of what I'm experiencing in the workplace, but also that entrepreneurial spirit that you are building in the future generations of workforces is so important. I lead a technology company that delivers IT and professional services to the US government in areas like artificial intelligence and cloud, machine learning, cybersecurity, and technology is evolving at a pace that is unprecedented. And the mission and requirements of national security and our government are evolving at a really fast pace. And so bringing a spirit of innovation and curiosity and entrepreneurship is exactly what I hope my future workforce has. So thank you for what you're inculcating in the future workforce of America.
Yeah.
Amy, I'd love to thank you for that. And I'd love to hear how you came with all everything that you manage, including 30,000 people, by the way, how you came to focus on this problem. And I love the name of your solution. I think it's How Are You Really, which is amazing. So talk to us about how you came to this and a little bit about your program.
Sure. So with 30,000 employees, you are a subset of America. And if you are a deck plates kind of leader, it does not escape you when your employees are being challenged. And so in COVID, again, we serve national security. And so we saw the threats to national security evolve, and now with Ukraine and how we're supporting what's going on over there. We also support a broad set of other government missions, like responding or helping FEMA respond to national emergencies or weather disasters, for instance, or the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid supporting the millions of Americans that receive services there. So in any event, a short way to say this is that people are struggling even before COVID, but coming out of COVID in particular, everybody in many places lost things during COVID. And we were seeing that our workforce was stressed and anxious, and that they had perhaps lost some of the support net that they had before COVID, and that they really needed help. And it came to the forefront for me personally. I got a call. I had taken a long weekend off, and one of my leaders called on Monday to tell me that we had lost an employee to suicide. And this was a very visible employee, and it was a stunning realization that, yes, people are not okay. And I want to highlight that my workforce is a little bit unique from maybe a more traditional company workforce, because I have many veterans in my workforce. So almost a third of the population of GDIT are veterans. And then I have almost 15,000 employees that have national security clearances. And in both of those populations, there is a stigma around talking openly about mental health challenges. And so the combination of having stress from the real world and employees that are otherwise probably reticent to talk about it meant that the work my leadership needed to lean in. And I believe that the workplace needs to be a source of resources and to address a problem that I will call an epidemic.
Thank you for employing so many veterans. I think that's so cool. And I imagine it's also challenging in many ways. So, and yeah, thank you for sharing that hard story. I think unfortunately, often we come to mental health and mental illness through trauma, you know, and what we want to do is get on the preventative side, right?
Well, no, exactly. And so I came back and looked at my leadership team and said, like, we need to do something about this. We can create community. We can have resources. And so we launched this campaign, How Are You Really? And this was born out of, it's all organic, came from our employees developing this, because we always ask, how are you? But you're generally walking away, moving on to your next thought, like, not lingering to actually and want the answer or to listen to it. And so we didn't want it to be a perfunctory question anymore. And that enabled us to start bringing in resources around how can we support that? How can we make this a conversation that is okay? How can we make it okay to not be okay at General Dynamics and to raise your hand and say, I need some help, I need some time away. So we started looking into our resources, we started hosting conversations, we started having our leadership talk about it, and it has really grown from there. Internal campaign to talking to it more broadly in our industry and externally. And, I will tell you that there is not a topic that I am asked about or emailed about more than how are you really?
We're going to circle back to more about that program because I think it's such a great opportunity to use a case study. But I want to come back to Emily because I love having academics because they have statistics and research and they also spend a lot of time defining things. So Emily, I saw in your review that about 20% of Americans right now are suffering from a mental illness, and you distinguish this idea of mental illness from mental health. Can you start there with like, what are the definitions of those two things? Because I think that could help all of us understanding that.
Yeah. And I will preface this with the fact that there are certainly reasonable people who sort of disagree about the contours of these definitions. For me and for my co-authors, we feel really strongly, though, that at least people start to think about mental health and mental illness as overlapping, but not entirely synonymous, because that opens up places for conversations about how we can support workers that are really important to have and they get lost if we get messy about the distinction. So when we talk about mental illness, what we're really looking at is chronic psychological conditions. So not people who are feeling sad for a week, but people with major depressive disorder or generalized anxiety disorder, that is something that is chronic, that is something that is, you know, maybe not always, but perhaps at times impairing for them. And psychologists have different ways that they diagnose different psychiatric conditions. But that's really what we're looking at for mental illness. For mental health, and so that 20% statistic you mentioned was actually pre-COVID. People, you know, 20% of people pre-COVID will have a mental illness that is diagnosed or diagnosable. Post-COVID, I don't think we've really settled on a number yet. The general consensus is obviously it's much, much higher. But research, unfortunately, moves much slower than industry because we have a rigorous peer review process. It takes many years. And we're still sort of seeing the fallout from that. We're still seeing work change and evolve and attitudes about mental health change and evolve sort of in direct relation to people's experiences during COVID that Amy talked about. I think that's what I'm seeing a lot of across all leaders and all industries I talk to is that, you know, people are suffering maybe in ways that they hadn't suffered before and sort of looking to community and looking to their workplace to help support them. Mental health is much broader. Mental health is sort of, are you able to, you know, cope with work? Are you able to thrive? Poor mental health overlaps with mental illness. So, you know, feeling symptoms of anxiety and depression maybe that may or may not be clinically significant or may or may not be long-term, but they may be temporary. So things like becoming burned out at work, burnout is not a mental illness, but it's certainly poor mental health. And so there is that overlap. We know less, certainly from a management perspective, but there are open questions in psychology too. When does that chronic burnout from work actually turn into something like major depressive disorder? But if we're just talking about poor mental health and mental illness in the same way, we miss opportunities to ask those questions. So that's one type of important question. That question is important because it informs where managers can intervene. So how they can stop burnout, for instance, before it progresses to something like a more impairing major depressive disorder. So that's one of the reasons that that distinction is really important for me and my colleagues. The other reason is because not all chronic mental illness is actually impairing or bad for work or indicates poor mental health. So for instance, if you take something like bipolar disorder, many people with bipolar disorder, it is a lifelong condition, but many people have it well managed, don't necessarily have severe flare-ups. And so the other half of the conversation, once we distinguish mental health from mental illness, is how can organizations and managers help people with chronic conditions to thrive in the workplace. And there is really interesting research that certain kinds of diagnosed psychiatric conditions, bipolar disorder, can actually have positive effects for performance under some conditions. And so it's about how can organizations support the maybe slightly different needs or maybe fluctuating needs of people with diagnosed chronic mental illness so that they can have good workplace mental health, or so they can have good mental health in general. And there's this other sort of stream of research that we don't talk about as much in business, I think, but that is really important, that is for people with chronic mental illness, work can actually be a restorative function. And so work can give meaning and self-esteem and can actually really be healing and productive. And so the extent to which organizations can support employees with mental illness, which is sort of a separate question from just preventing poor mental health, I think has a lot of opportunities for us to find some cool information.
Amazing. Yeah, I guess I did see a post-COVID stat that was 27%, but I think we're going to find out what it really is. And there's certainly big swings with younger people, right?
Yeah.
Thank you for all that amazing information. I'm going to go back to Amy, and I'm curious about what resources you had to bring in, right, as part of this program, and how does it work? What are the mechanics of it?
Sure. Well, I look at resources in a couple of different buckets. One of the resources is simply expectations of leadership. And that isn't something that you think of in the traditional bucket of resources, but acceptance and as a leadership team, leaning into the fact that leaders are expected to be looking for signals of burnout or struggling employees, and that we should start having conversations about these things and making it acceptable to have these conversations. That was first and foremost for us. And I think that then falls into the other buckets of resources that we looked at, which, you know, first of all, is how can you build community? And resources, again, is putting people that can help build community in positions to do so. And so for us, our employee resource groups have been a tremendous sense of a way to build community. People are looking in some ways just to try and find connection in a world that may be more isolated and filled with anxiety than it was before COVID. And sometimes people feel more comfortable doing so in affinity kinds of groups, which employee resource groups are built around. So we have a veterans resource group, and we have topics in that resource group around veteran suicide and experts that come from the veteran community to talk to those. Now, any employee can come to that conversation, but oftentimes you see more of a veteran population come there, or we have an Hispanic employee resource group. We have a women's resource group. We also, by the way, have technical resource groups. So perhaps you're a cloud developer and you want to be with other cloud developers. I think Emily made such a great point about the fact that work can actually help solve some of the anxiety that you have, because you're then focused on something that you are really absorbed and compelled by. And so we've tried to create community in that way, also by bringing people that are like-minded around topics that we're working on. And then the final way that I think about resources is maybe in the more traditional sense of what are the employee benefits here at GDIT. And no, I will be frank and say that the benefits that we have today are not the same benefits that we had before COVID. And that is informed by the reality of what our employees are dealing with from a mental health challenge perspective. So for instance, we have online counseling now. I think before the pandemic, online counseling was not as prevalent, but we need to make that readily accessible for employees so that they can do that when they have the moment to do so. So we also created resources like concierge service. So I happen to be a special needs mother, but everybody is dealing maybe with something in their life where they need a little bit more help in scheduling medical appointments, navigating insurance, these kinds of things that can really weigh on the mental well-being of our employees. And we've seen tremendous pickup there. In fact, so much so that we are now using it to help teens, because I think you and Emily both point pointed out that some of the surge that we've seen has been in our children, who of course had to navigate COVID and had very different experiences from school. We also have sort of reimagined our employee assistance program, often known as EAP. You know, I will just tell you from my own perspective coming up in a workforce, EAP also had a stigma with it. And so we needed to debunk that stigma and reintroduce this resource as a place that you could go to for help. And then just in our how are you really, we had to provide resources to help leaders have conversations, because I love your notion of well-intentioned managers. We have a lot of people that want to lean in and help, but having a conversation about, like, you don't seem like yourself, how are you? That could be, my 12-year-old would call it awkward. You know, that can be very awkward. And we want to make that a conversation that can easily be had. And so we've put resources in our How Are You Really portion of our intranet. And we also have it externally so that managers can go there and have almost a script, or these are the things you should be looking for, and this is how you can get the conversation started.
I appreciate all those things you're doing. And it does occur to me that if 20 to 30% of us are suffering with a disorder, it means that we love someone with a disorder, right? So I see a lot of parents that are, you know, dealing with very, you know, serious diagnoses with their kids and their teens. And that even if you're doing okay, if someone you love is not, yes, it really affects everything.
No, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. When you come to work, you don't leave what's at home. It's still weighing on you. And when national security and government missions are your job, your ability to focus on your job and your customer is not what it could be because you are thinking, there's nothing like the worry of a parent, I can tell you.
Yeah. So Emily, what else did you find, like, in the broader, you know, we have a thought leader here. I feel like she's kind of ahead of head of the crowd, but what are you and your colleagues suggesting to companies, based on your research?
Yeah. And I loved hearing all about what Amy is doing, because so much of that really exemplifies, what are the best practices that we're finding in research. So what we've found is that there are really two conversations or two ways that leaders need to be thinking about supporting employees' mental health simultaneously. So one is changing the organization, changing work so that it is not a place that promotes poor mental health for employees. And so our research sort of suggested two main ways that companies can do that. So one is actually exactly what Amy was talking about, and is probably the harder one, which is changing the culture of the organization. So removing stigma, making it okay to stop what you're doing for 20 minutes and, you know, confide in a friend or a coworker, and have that emotional support. And the research is really strong that social support in the workplace, both from managers and from coworkers, is clearly tied to improved mental health. And so changing, as Amy said, the expectations for leaders that it's okay to have these conversations. Maybe it's okay to pause your tasks at work during work hours and have these conversations. That goes so, so far. And that makes such a big difference on a global scale for all employees. And again, you don't have to have mental health challenges to have opportunities to have improved mental health. And so that's so important. The other sort of structural change about making sure that the organization at least isn't doing harm, is thinking about the way jobs are designed. So there is tons of research, decades and decades of really clear research that things like regularly having too many tasks assigned to your role where you're always sort of overworked and you're always getting burned out. Another thing that Amy mentioned was, you know, promoting work-life balance so that if you have something like a concierge service, you know, you're not sitting at work and wondering, okay, I have to schedule my kids, you know, doctor's appointment. I'm also a mother. I have a 6-year-old. And that sort of thing, like if you can eliminate some of those stressors, the research is really, really clear that that is tied to improved mental health. And so some of these things, and also another one that came up a surprising amount for us was just role clarity. So do you understand what you're responsible for in your job? And I know most of what I've taught in my career is courses in human resources. Mm-hmm. And so we think of that as sort of a boring bureaucratic HR issue, you know, writing job descriptions, but it ends up being so important. And that is a really tangible sort of low-hanging fruit mechanism that organizations can attend to, or even just informally, managers meeting with employees like, hey, I just want to make sure, you know, walk me through your day. This is what it says you're doing on paper. Is that what you're doing in real life? And if employees are regularly taking on things that they're not responsible for, or they're unsure about it, then that's an opportunity to clarify. And really, that's sort of an easy pain point to address. And I don't mean to oversimplify it. Obviously, it takes time. It takes resources. We all know that that's very scarce in most large organizations. But it is at least sort of a clear pain point that we can address. And the other one is relevant to a lot of what Amy is doing in her company is supporting employees with what we call exogenous challenges. So challenges that aren't caused by their work, but are caused by a stressor in their family life, a diagnosed mental illness. In you know the population that Amy described, perhaps veterans who have you know higher rates of things like PTSD, that didn't come from work, but those are things that need to be supported in work. And so things like I think online counseling access is so important because we know just in general barriers for people getting the help that they want, the support for their mental health is things like really practical things. Can I leave work to drive to a therapist's office during business hours? Well, in some companies, that's possible. In some companies, there's at least sort of an informal stigma about leaving in the afternoon and then making up the work at night. So changing the culture around that, but also the explicit rules about flexibility. So things like online counseling is amazing because, you know, that cuts out the commute time, that cuts out a lot of the hassle. Cost is another huge barrier. Many health insurance programs are not great at covering mental health at the same level as they cover physical health. So organizations can make sure that they're offering benefits that really do provide that financial support as well. So thinking about how we can support employees with, you know, who are struggling for non-work reasons, and then how we can make sure that work is not making employees' mental health worse.
Love that point.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Amy.
No, I love that point about flexibility, because when you asked me before, Laurel, about resources, flexibility is another resource that doesn't necessarily cost money. It just costs a little creative thinking. And we definitely found during COVID that we could be more flexible than we thought we could be. So trying to hang on to the best lessons there and give people the opportunity to do some of the things that they need to do when it's advantageous, even if that maybe it brings them joy to go watch their kids' soccer game in the afternoon and then they get their work done later, or just Emily, you'd like to pick your, you know, I have a 5-year-old, like you'd like to meet the bus one day, or you'd like to do the school pickup one day, because that's, he or she will only be 5 or 6 once. Those sorts of things really, really do resonate and can bring joy in small ways.
I loved so many things that you said, Emily, but I was smiling broadly because I'm an old school HR person. That's where I came from. And we do something at our company with our clients called culture audits. And I love to look at job descriptions, training checklists, and organizational charts. Not everyone does, but it's one of my passions. And in my company, everyone has to memorize their job description. So they have to be really short. And we review them, you know, every couple of months because everything's changing so fast. But I think you brought it home so many points, but you know, I think so many people are sitting in front of their computers wondering what their job is. You know, so role clarification. It feels like old school HR, but I love that it's coming mm-hmm. back. I think I could spend all day talking to both of you, but I'm curious about two things: your take on 4-day work weeks, and how does remote working play into all of this? And Amy, you can start based on your experience.
So I, as a government contractor, our schedules are largely set by our government customers. And so don't have the kind of flexibility necessarily around 4-day work weeks. Now, with that being said, we did lean into flexibility over 2 weeks. So employees have the ability, if their customer allows them to, if they work their 80 hours and they get to Friday at the end of the 2 week pay period, then they can take that day off. So we have tried to push the boundaries of what that could look like. To your second question, just about what does remote work look like, that is also governed in large part by our customers. And so we have varied statuses, and we're really trying to be intentional when we come together. And so it is, from my perspective, about community. People, they find joy in work, at least in our industry. People are attracted by the national security mission and serving, helping the government deliver what it needs to for its citizens. That's what motivates them. That's what differentiates technologists that come to work for GDIT from technologists that come to work elsewhere. And so in creating a workplace that they can come to where they feel like they are seen, where they feel like they can thrive and evolve in their careers, where their managers genuinely care. We say we want to build a company with a soul that delivers, feeling like they're part of that company. You have to be very deliberate about that when people aren't 5 days a week, 8 hours a day in the office. And so we have tried to lean into building a community and to bringing people together when they are in the office, because, you know, flexibility is important, and feeling like you are a part of a team that supports you is also important.
I love this idea of intentionality when you do come together. What types of things do you do when you're actually face to face that might be different than when you're on the computer?
Well, so we have, I'll give you one example. We have a leaders forum next week. So when you're dealing with meaty issues in an organization, like mental health, for instance, I could talk all day about mental health, but I can't drive that into the bowels of an organization with 30,000 employees. My leaders have to really drive that. And so we have a leaders forum where the leaders that report to my direct reports, if you will, so if that makes sense, two levels below me, we bring them together into a room and we talk about where we're successful, where we're having challenges, and how we are doing on our goals for the year. And people goals are a huge part of what we're doing this year. And so we involve the leaders in that conversation. So that is a place that says, hey, could we do that by Zoom? Well, we could. And if there's a reason why a particular leader can't come, they can tune in from Zoom. But hey, if you can be here, because this leadership team, particularly when you have turnover in our industry, probably about 30-35% of our employees are new since COVID, and we have to really lean into that. And there's so many ideas and conversations that happen when you are in the room together that don't when you're on Zoom. So we really try to schedule forums like that where people can come together.
Thank you, Amy. And Emily, your take on those two topics?
Yeah, I think Amy has already articulated a lot of what I was going to say, and that there is certainly a balance to consider. I don't think I would say universally that four-day work weeks are good or bad. I think the research backs that they can be good in the right circumstances. But also, as Amy said, that's not possible in a lot of jobs. And so, for instance, if you're a barista, you can't just work fewer days and then take off Friday and nobody gets coffee. Like, you know, it's just not possible everywhere. And so I think that an underlying emphasis on flexibility. So where can you be flexible? When can you be flexible? That will look different for every company, for certainly by industry, that looks very different. And the same for remote work. I think it's sort of two manifestations of the same issue, which is this push towards allowing for greater flexibility, which is very closely tied to mental health. Certainly not making employees' mental health worse from an organizational perspective, and allowing employees with different needs to meet those needs, you know, while still performing their job. But at the same time, balancing that with community. And the research is very clear that these social ties are important, both as Amy said, for, you know, creating that culture, but also the individual social ties are important. And there is tons of good research about why we don't connect as well on Zoom. And sometimes we forge good enough connections, but really there isn't a replacement for in-person communication and the relationships that are built on that. And it's, you know, everything from what we call micro moves, where people sort of get extra information about someone subconsciously by, you know, small body movements. They sort of start to mirror their conversational partner's small body movements. Like, that actually fosters additional feelings of closeness that people aren't aware of, but that really add up over time to create stronger relationships. So it is a balancing act. And that's why I think it's really important for companies, certainly to be intentional, as Amy said, but to think about how they can customize issues of flexibility, issues of promoting strong culture, issues of fostering social support in the workplace, and what that looks like for their company. So for instance, I worked several jobs as a barista in high school, which is why, and in college, which is why I often use that example. You know, we can't necessarily work from home. Obviously, that doesn't work. You can't make somebody's coffee from home. But if you're thinking about, okay, work-life conflict, you know, we know that that is a huge exacerbating factor for poor mental health. Can you at least give employees the same schedule every week so that they can plan around it, as opposed to changing their shifts? Sometimes they work in the morning, sometimes they work different days. So that they can, you know, reduce as much as possible how that work schedule conflicts with their life, so that they can plan ahead, so there isn't that sense of uncertainty or rushing at the last minute. And so I think really keeping the principles in mind, but then getting really creative, as it sounds like Amy's done, with what that can look like unique to the occupational context.
I just had an experience. I so believe that there's so many things missed on Zoom. And I work primarily on Zoom. I have a business partner in India. I work with teenagers all over the world. So there's some wonderful things that I can do on Zoom. But I have an event that I do every year with a group of college seniors from the business school at the University of Denver. So we do a retreat with them. It's now called the Fritz Leadership Symposium. Fritz is the hospitality school, so Emily, you'd appreciate that. And that's my undergrad, is hospitality. And I was doing, we've done this for 5 years. We just did our fifth year. And we did one all on Zoom, which was so hard because it's an emotional program. It's really developing your leadership from the inside out. And then last year I do three events with them over the year. And I insist on doing all of them in person because it's a completely different experience. But this year I came home on Sunday from doing a 2-day retreat with them. And this week has been hard for me. And I think it's because I was with people, young people, 25 young people that were dealing with a lot of anxiety and depression. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I would ever get that on Zoom. You know, I have good intuition and I work with people emotionally on Zoom, but like I physically could feel things that I wouldn't, you know, and they're really good actors and actresses, right? So everyone can sit up and be bright and shiny, but I think there's something about just, even if you have a big company, like bringing people together as much as possible, and to have those conversations. I could talk to you both all day, but you're very important, busy women. I'm curious if you have any questions for each other.
Emily, I do have a question for you, and it One of the things that we have tried to focus on this year is our people managers, so our leaders, because we realize that leadership in the post-COVID era is different when you are managing. You've got new generations coming into the workforce. You have this reality of different work postures. You have the anxiety and burnout and all of those things coming together. And that's a lot of pressure on our leaders themselves. And so we've tried to provide training this year for our leaders to try and equip them with tools for how to have some of these conversations, because we know that they're on the front lines of retaining our employees from a business perspective and protecting them and they're or at least supporting them. Or I like to think we're doing that more than not being a burden, which I appreciate what you say there, but we really actually want to be a resource for them. Do you have ideas or things that you've discovered in your research that we can bring to bear to help support our managers?
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And that is one that often gets lost in the conversation. I think once people get promoted to managers, there's somehow this implicit expectation that they're going to have answers, they're going to have more resources. And that's usually not true. I mean, in some companies, there isn't even leadership training at all. It's if you were a good engineer, then you're promoted to engineering manager, engineering supervisor. But leadership is a skill, and leadership is a set of competencies that oftentimes organizations may forget to train people in or to evaluate people on as they're making these promotion decisions. But in terms of leaders' mental health, the statistics I've seen are that managers' mental health is actually worse than rank and file employees' mental health because, as you say, they have their own lives, their own pressures, the pressures of every other employee, but also then the additional pressures of expectations to support their subordinates. And so I think it sounds like a lot of what you've been doing is what we recommend. So giving them training, something that I did at my last institution. So prior to being at Babson, I was an assistant professor at California State University, Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And my student population there was relatively different in that it was a human resources program. So most of them were going into HR roles or into people management roles in various ways. And so I taught a really fun class on diversity and inclusion. And I actually brought in somebody from the National Alliance of Mental Illness to give them training. So I said, you know, at some point, sooner than later, if you're in HR, if you're a manager, an employee is going to come to you and expect you to be able to support them. And what I found in some of my research is some managers are actually afraid to have that conversation if they don't feel prepared. They're like, I want to help, but I don't want to make it worse. What if I ask them something and then, you know, I don't want to know the answer. I'm not equipped to the answer. And so I told my students, I'm like, you know, you can behave however you want in your organizations, but I never want you to not help someone because you're afraid. You're afraid you don't know how, you don't have the resources. And so I actually got them, I had them all certified as part of the class in something called QPR, which is sort of the psychiatry equivalent of CPR, which is just if you see someone in psychiatric distress, can you keep them alive long enough to get them to a professional who can help? So not teaching them how to be therapists, not teaching them how to give advice, just can you keep someone safe and alive? And so NAMI came in and actually did that training for all of my students. And so I think as a society, the earlier we can start the conversation, can we have these conversations and these trainings even in the business school population? So when students enter the workforce, even before they're in that managerial position, they have these competencies. And so it's less on the shoulders of individual corporations to help their managers and more just something that's integrated into business curricula, because it is becoming a, you know, really required business competency for managers. So that's one thing I think is the more training and the earlier training we can do, I think that that causes a seismic shift in a really good way. But also I think being really clear with managers about what the expectations are. So if the goal is destigmatizing mental health challenges, which I agree is a really, really important goal in this regard, not all managers might be ready to tell if they have a personal story with that. And so I think I have seen in other companies where there's a pressure for managers to feel like they have to take on more than they're comfortable or more than they're ready for. The most recent statistics are about a third of employees with a mental health challenge won't tell anybody at work, don't want to tell anybody. And sometimes for very good reason, especially in industries where there is a more pervasive societal stigma about mental illness, they're right that people might look at them differently in those contexts. And so I think having managers sort of be able to take on and have the tools and the freedom and the latitude to take on that support role, but also having alternate forms of support. So as you mentioned, you know, you've reimagined your employee assistance program. There are those other employee resource groups are really, really good. The research shows that that's in fact a very successful way to accomplish a whole bunch of good business outcomes in addition to perhaps mental health benefits. But are there multiple sources of social support? Are there multiple touch points? You know, is there somebody in HR who just is able to field basic questions about health benefits or things mm-hmm. like that? And so I think making sure that managers don't feel that pressure to do it all or to, you know, become too personally involved mm-hmm. or personally disclosing, I think is really, really important in preventing their poor mental health.
That's really helpful. The QPR, I'm taking that.
Yeah, that's so great. That's, I love that. We all need QPR. Emily, have any questions for Amy?
I do. So sort of piggybacking off of what I was just mentioning, this idea that employee resource groups are really good. And I've seen organizations struggle sometimes with getting people to participate in employee resource groups because we all have so much going on. It's just sort of one more meeting that maybe they don't have the time for. They wish they could, but something else is going on. And so I'm wondering how you've sort of managed to get this good participation that it sounds like exists because it is such a beneficial resource if employees will take advantage of it.
Yeah, well, it's a journey. So I'll start there. We're on it. And it's been organically. So I think one of the ways is that if you bring good content to these discussions, they perpetuate themselves. And so we have been really focused on bringing excellent speakers, listening to the employee resource groups and their leadership about what content might resonate, what they're looking for, what format might resonate, because the last thing you want to do, for instance, is come to a 12 o'clock lunch and learn where somebody just speaks to you and transmits for an hour. That's so boring. Yeah. And on topics that are potentially, you know, people could ask questions or engage. And so how can we deliver those in ways that seem to resonate? So that has been great. Another thing that I would say about how we have been able to do it is, yeah, maybe they can't come at the time that they're scheduled, but we make them available on the internet so people can download them and listen to them when they're commuting home or when it might be more or in a place where they feel like they could listen to it in private or however. We've also done something sort of the anathema to what I just said. So that's appropriate for some, but for some people want a safe place where they could ask a question and it's not recorded. Mm-hmm. So if you think about having a veteran suicide, which we've had experts come in and people have asked questions and they can be off camera and this isn't recorded and something that would be available. So we tried to be sensitive and really take the cue from our employee resource groups. I will tell you the other thing that we have done is that we have encouraged the employee resource groups to work together. So if you have the young professionals organization teaming with the Black employee organization. First of all, and I love this comment that you made before, you may bring employees together that otherwise might not have found each other. And that's an important source of community. And we love that. And you oftentimes find richer topics, richer forums than you might if you had looked at it just through the lens of that one employee group. So I wouldn't say that we've mastered this journey yet. We are very much in a, hey, how did that work? You know, we are part of a larger corporation, General Dynamics, and 10 business units were one of those. We've teamed with employee resource groups in other business units. And so the world gets a little bit bigger. So I'd say that we're a creative and it's very much evolving, but we are thrilled with the progress that we've made. And I do see that it is helpful to that company with a soul that we're striving to build.
I want to thank you both for being such a dynamic duo. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor. This is a near and dear topic to me. I think you bring up a good point on confidentiality and anonymity. I know for myself, when I was in the corporate world, I didn't talk about my own struggles with mental health, but as an entrepreneur and I'm my own boss, I can talk more about things like I am from a family with a lot of addiction and mental health issues. My mother was bipolar. I celebrated 32 years sober last week. And I totally believe that work, the right work and the right culture and the right mission, can heal you. And I'm so glad that this conversation is happening. I wanted you both to know, because of your efforts and because of your good work, you've both been nominated by me to be Compassionate Leader Circle Award nominees for next year. And we'll circle back with you on that. But thank you for joining me today. It's been a pleasure and an honor to have you both.
Thank you so much for having us.
Such an important conversation. Thank you.
And that's a heart-wrapped episode of the Compassionate Leader Circle podcast. May your compass always point to kindness.
As you navigate the world, let compassion be your North Star. Join us next time as we continue to redefine success one heart-led decision at a time.
Lead wisely, lead with heart. You can learn more about us at CompassionateLeadersCircle.com.